As she gave herself a last-minute check in the tall mirror in her dressing room, she gathered her determination and marshaled all of her arguments. The slightest objection must be met instantly. Carefully, she put herself in an imperial frame of mind, and taking the rolled parchment, she moved toward the door. The council chamber in which the Elorn kings usually gathered was a large room high up in one of the massive towers of the citadel. There were heavy beams on the ceiling, a deep maroon carpet on the floor, and a fireplace at the far end big enough to stand in. Maroon drapes flanked the windows where tatters of rain slashed across the solid stones of the tower. The walls of the chamber were covered with maps, and the large table was littered with parchments and ale cups. King Unheg, in his blue robe and dented crown, sprawled in the nearest chair, as shaggy and brutish-looking as always. King Rodar was vast in his crimson mantle, but the other kings and generals wore rather plain clothing. Synedra entered the chamber without knocking, and stared regally at the somewhat confused men who struggled to their feet in acknowledgment of her presence.
"Your Highness," King Rodar began with a portly bow, "you honor us. Was there—"
"Your Majesty," she responded with a little curtsy. "And gentlemen, I find that I need your advice in a matter of state."
"We are all at your immediate disposal, Your Highness," King Rodar replied, with a sly little twinkle in his eyes.
"In the absence of King Belgarion, it appears that I must act in his stead," Synedra announced. "And I need your advice on how to proceed. I wish the transfer of power into my hands to go as smoothly as possible."
They all stared at her disbelievingly. King Rodar recovered his wits first.
"An interesting proposal, Your Highness," he murmured politely. "We have, however, made other arrangements. There's a long-standing precedent in the matter. We thank Your Highness for her gracious offer, nonetheless."
"It was not precisely an offer, Your Majesty," Synedra told him, "and any previous precedents have been superseded."
King Unheg was spluttering, but Rodar was already moving along smoothly. Synedra realized that the rotund Drasnian king was likely to be her most serious adversary, or her most effective ally.
"We would all be fascinated to examine the instrument vesting Your Highness with royal authority," he said. "I presume that the parchment you carry is relevant?"
"It is indeed, Your Majesty. The document quite clearly lists my responsibilities."
"May I?" Rodar asked, extending his hand.
Synedra handed him the parchment, and he carefully unrolled it.
"Your Highness, this is your betrothal agreement. Perhaps you meant to bring a different document?"
"The pertinent material is contained in the fourth paragraph, Your Majesty."
Rodar quickly read the paragraph, frowning slightly.
"What does it say, Rodar?" King Unheg asked impatiently. "Interesting," Rodar murmured, scratching his ear.
"Rodar," Unheg complained, "what does it say?"
King Rodar cleared his throat and began to read aloud.
"It is agreed that King Belgarion and his queen shall rule jointly, and that in his absence shall she assume fully the duties and authority of the Riven Throne."
"Let me see that," Unheg demanded, snatching the parchment from Rodar.
"It doesn't mean anything," Brand declared. "She isn't his queen yet. She won't be until after the wedding."
"That is only a formality, my Lord Warder," Synedra told him.
"A rather important one, I'd say," he retorted.
"The precedent is well established. When a king dies, the next in line assumes the duties of the crown, doesn't he? Even though there has not been a formal coronation?"
"That's different," Brand growled.
"I fail to see the difference, my lord. I have been designated Belgarion's co-ruler. In his absence or an emergency, I am obliged to take command. It is my right and my responsibility. The formalities may have to wait, but I am the Riven Queen. This is King Belgarion's will and intent, Will you defy your king?
There is something to what she says, my Lord Walder,
the Earl of Selene mused.
The document is quite clear.
But look at this, Unheg said triumphantly. In paragraph 2 it says that should the wedding not take place, all gifts are to be returned. The wedding has not taken place.
I'm not sure that power is a gift, Unheg, King Thorak suggested.
You can't give it and then take it back.
There's no way she can rule, Unheg declared stubbornly. She doesn't know the first thing about Elons.
Neither did Geryon, King Hohag murmured in his quiet voice. She can learn the same way he did.
Tenedra had been rather carefully assessing their mood. Most of them seemed willing at least to consider her idea. Only the two conservatives, Brand and Unheg, were actually resisting. It seemed the time now for a dignified withdrawal coupled with a disarming offer.
I will leave you gentlemen to discuss the matter, she declared somewhat loftily. I would like you to know, however, that I realize the gravity of the situation confronting the West.
She deliberately put on a winsome little girl face.
I am only a young girl, she confessed. Unused to the intricacies of strategy and tactics, I could never make any decisions in that area without the fullest advice from you gentlemen.
She curtsied then to King Rodar, choosing him deliberately.
Your Majesty, she said, I shall await your decision.
He bowed in response, a bit floridly.
Your Majesty,
he replied with a sly wink. Tenedra retired and literally flew down the corridors to her own quarters. Breathlessly, she closed the door behind her and touched the talisman at her throat with trembling fingertips. She sorted quickly through random conversation until she found the one she wanted.
Refuse to be a party to an absurdity, Unheg was saying.
Unheg, my friend, King Folrak of Sindaria said with surprising firmness.
You're my dear brother king. But you do have a few blind spots. Wouldn't it be more statesmanlike to consider the advantages and disadvantages of the situation dispassionately?
The Elons will never follow her, Unheg declared. That's a major disadvantage right there.
The Elons will follow us, though, King Hohag said quietly. She is only going to be a figurehead, after all, a symbol of unity.
I suspect that Hohag has hit the exact point we should examine most closely, King Rodar urged. My apologies, Baron Andorallan, but the Arryns are totally disunited. Asturia and Mimbre are hovering on the verge of reopening hostilities, and the call from King Coradulan could very possibly be ignored in northern Arindia, in which case the Mimbrate knights would almost be compelled to stay home to defend against possible Asturian uprisings. We have to have someone who can make them forget their squabbles and join with us. We need the Asturian bowmen and the Mimbrate knights.
I must sadly concur, Your Majesty, Mandarallan agreed. My poor Arindia must needs be united in one cause from the outside. We are not wise enough to unify ourselves.
Tenedra can serve us there as well as Geryon could have done, Barak reasoned. I don't think anybody expected him to be a general. All we were going to do was to put the crown on him and let him ride at the head of the army. And the errands get all gushy and romantic about pretty girls. That betrothal document makes her claim at least semi-legitimate. All we'd have to do is to act as if we accepted her and talk very fast. Add the prospect of a nice little war someplace, and the errands will unite behind us, I think.
The main point to consider, though, King Rodar emphasized, is the impact she's going to have in Tenedra. Ranbarun dotes on her, and he might agree to lend her his legions
at least some of the time, which he would never do if we were the ones asking it of him.
He'll see the political advantage of having her in command almost immediately. We need those legions. I personally do not like the Tonedrans, but the legions are the finest fighting force in the world. I would bend my knee to Sinedra if I have to in order to get them. Let her play queen if she wants to.
Sinedra smiled. Things were going even better than she had expected. All in all, she was quite pleased with herself as she sat down at her dressing table and began to brush her hair, humming softly all the while. Chapter 23. Delban, the armorer, was a gruff, bald man with broad shoulders, huge calloused hands, and a grizzled beard. He was a craftsman, an artist, and he had absolutely no respect for anyone. Sinedra found him to be impossible.
"I don't make armor for women,"
was his initial response to her inquiry when she, accompanied by Durnick the smith, entered his shop. He then turned his back on her and began pounding noisily on a sheet of glowing steel. It took the better part of an hour to convince him even to consider the idea. The heat shimmered out of his glowing forge, and the red brick walls seemed to reflect the heat and intensify it. Sinedra found herself perspiring heavily. She had made some sketches of what she thought might be a suitable design for her armor. All in all, she thought it would look rather nice, but Delban laughed raucously when he saw them.
"What is so amusing?"
"You'd be like a turtle in something like that," he replied. "You wouldn't be able to move."
"The drawings are only intended to give you a general idea," she told him, trying to keep a grip on her temper.
"Now, why don't you be a good girl and take these to a dressmaker?" he suggested. "I'll work in steel, not brocade or satin. Armor like this would be useless, so uncomfortable that you wouldn't be able to wear it."
"Then modify it," she grated from between clenched teeth.
He glanced at her design again, then deliberately crumpled her drawings in his fist and threw them into the corner.
"Foolishness," he grunted.
Sinedra resisted the urge to scream. She retrieved the drawings.
"What is the matter with them?"
she persisted.
"Too much here."
He stabbed a thick finger at the shoulder represented on the drawing.
"You wouldn't be able to lift your arm. And here,"
he pointed at the armhole in the breastplate she had drawn,
"if I make it that tight, your arms would stick straight out. You wouldn't even be able to scratch your nose. As long as we're at it, where did you get the whole notion in the first place? Do you want a mail shirt or a breastplate? You can't have both."
"Why not?"
"The weight. You wouldn't be able to carry it."
"Make it lighter, then. Can't you do that?"
"I can make it like cobwebs if you want, but what good would it be if I did? You could cut through it with a paring knife."
Sinedra drew in a deep breath.
"Master Armorer,"
she said to him in a level voice,
"look at me. In all of the world, do you think there is a single warrior small enough for me to fight?"
He considered her tiny form, scratching his bald head and looking down at her with pursed lips.
"You are a bit undergrown. If you aren't going to fight, why do you need armor?"
"It's not actually going to be armor," she explained to him rather impatiently. "But I need to look like I'm wearing armor. It's sort of in the nature of a costume."
She saw instantly that her choice of words had been a mistake. Delvin's face darkened, and he threw her drawings away again. It took another 10 minutes to mollify him. Eventually, after much wheedling and outrageous flattery, she persuaded him to consider the whole notion as something in the nature of an artistic challenge.
"All right,"
he surrendered finally with a sour look.
"Take off your clothes."
"What?"
"Take your dress off. I need exact measurements."
"Do you realize what you're suggesting?"
"Little girl," he said testily, "I am a married man. I've got daughters older than you. You are wearing underclothes now, aren't you?"
"Yes, but..."
"That will satisfy the demands of modesty. Take off that dress."
With a flaming face, Sinedra removed her dress, Durnick, the smith, who had watched the entire exchange from the doorway with an open grin on his face, politely turned his back.
"You ought to eat more," Delbin told her. "You're as scrawny as a chicken."
"I can do without the comments," she replied tartly. "Get on with this. I'm not going to stand around in my chemise all day."
Delbin picked up a piece of stout cord with knots tied in it at regular intervals. He took a great many measurements with the cord, meticulously recording them on a piece of flat board.
"All right, that ought to do it. Go ahead, get dressed again."
Ginedra scrambled back into her dress.
"How long will it take?"
2, maybe 3 weeks.
"Impossible, I need it next week."
2 weeks, he repeated stubbornly.
10 days,
she countered. For the first time since she had entered his workshop, the blunt man smiled.
"She's rather used to getting her own way, isn't she?"
he observed to Durnick.
"Well, she's a princess," Durnick informed him. "She usually gets what she wants in the end." "All right, my scrawny little princess," Delbin laughed at her. 10 days.
Sinedra beamed at him.
"I knew you would see it my way."
Precisely 10 days later, the princess, with Durnick once again in tow, returned to Delwyn's workshop. The male shirt the craftsman had fashioned was so light that it could almost have been described as delicate. The helmet, hammered from thin steel, was surmounted with a white plume and was encircled with a gold crown. The greaves, which were to protect the fronts of Tenedra's legs, fit to perfection. There was even an embossed shield rimmed with brass and a light sword with an ornate hilt and scabbard. Ginedra, however, was staring disapprovingly at the breastplate Delbin had made for her. It would quite obviously fit too well.
"Didn't you forget something?"
she asked him. He picked the breastplate up in his big hands and examined it.
"It's all there," he told her. "Front, back, all the straps to hook them together. What else did you want?"
"Isn't it a trifle understated?"
Ginedra suggested delicately.
"It's made to fit," he replied. "The understatement isn't my fault."
"I wanted a little more..."
She made a sort of curving gesture with her hands.
"What for?"
"Never mind what for. Just do it."
"What do you plan to put in it?"
"That's my business. Just do it the way I told you to."
He tossed a heavy hammer down onto his anvil.
"Do it yourself," he told her bluntly.
"Durnick,"
Ginedra appealed to the smith.
"Oh, no, princess. I don't touch another man's tools. That just isn't done."
"Please, Delbin,"
she wheedled.
"It's foolishness," he told her, his face set.
"It is important," she coaxed. "If I wear it like that, I'll look like a little boy. When people see me, they have to know that I am a woman. It's terribly, terribly important. Couldn't you, just a little bit?"
She cupped her hands slightly. Delbin gave Durnick a disgusted look.
"You had to bring her to my workshop, didn't you?" "Everybody said you were the best," Durnick replied mildly.
"Just a little bit, Delbin,"
Ginedra urged. He gave up.
"Oh, all right," he growled, picking up his hammer. "Anything to get you out of my shop. But not clear out to here." He made an exaggerated gesture.
"I would depend on your good taste, Delbin,"
she smiled, patting his cheek with a fond little laugh.
"Shall we say tomorrow morning?"
The armor, Ginedra decided the following morning as she inspected herself in the mirror, was perfect.
"Well? What do you think, Adara?"
she asked her friend.
"It looks very nice, Ginedra,"
the tall girl replied, although a bit dubiously.
"It's just exactly right,"
Ginedra said happily, turning so that the blue cape fastened to the shoulder pieces of the breastplate flared and swirled dramatically. The gleaming male shirt she wore under the breastplate reached to her knees and wrists. The greaves covering her calves and the arm guards reaching to her elbows were inlaid with brass. Delbin had steadfastly refused the notion of gold. The armor did chafe a bit through the thick linen undershirt she wore. Sinedra privately admitted, but she was prepared to accept that. She brandished her sword, studying the effect in her mirror.
"You are holding it wrong, Sinedra,"
Adara suggested politely.
"Show me,"
Sinedra said, handing over her sword. Adara took the weapon and gripped it firmly, its point low. She looked extremely competent.
"Where did you ever learn to do that?" Sinedra asked her. "We are given instruction,"
Adara replied, handing back the sword.
"It is traditional. Help me on with my shield,"
said Sinedra. Between them, they managed to gird the princess in all of her warlike equipment.
"However do you keep it from getting tangled up in your legs?"
Sinedra demanded, fumbling with the long scabbard at her waist.
"Hold on to the hilt,"
Adara told her.
"Do you want me to go along?"
Sinedra thought about that as she smoothed her hair and settled her plumed helmet more firmly in place.
"I guess not,"
she decided rather reluctantly.
"I think I'll have to face them alone. Do I really look all right?" "You will be fine,"
Adara assured her. A sudden thought struck the princess.
"What if they laugh?"
she demanded in a frightened voice.
"You could draw your sword on them, I suppose,"
Adara replied gravely.
"Are you making fun of me, Adara?"
"Of course not, princess,"
Adara answered with an absolutely straight face. When Sinedra reached the door to the council chamber, she drew in a deep breath and entered, once again without knocking. Knocking would have been inappropriate, suggesting somehow that she had doubts about her right to be there.
"Well, gentlemen,"
she said to the assembled kings and generals, as she stepped to the center of the room where they could all see her. King Rodar rose politely.
"Your Majesty," he greeted her, bowing. "We were curious about your absence. The reason is now abundantly clear."
"Do you approve?"
she could not help asking. She turned so they could all see her armor. King Rodar looked at her, his eyes speculative.
"It is impressive, don't you think?"
he said to the others.
"Just the right touches in the right places. The Arryns will flock to her, and the Tolnedrans. Well, we will have to see about the Tolnedrans."
King Anheg looked like a man having a serious struggle with himself.
"Why do I feel that I'm being pushed into something?" he complained. "The very notion of this makes my blood cold. But I can't think of any rational arguments against it."
He critically scrutinized Sinedra.
"She doesn't really look all that bad, does she?"
he conceded grudgingly.
"It is absolutely unnatural, of course, but the armor does add something. This might even work."
"I am so glad I meet with your Majesty's approval,"
Sinedra almost gushed at him. She tried to curtsy, but her armor made that impossible. She gave a helpless little laugh and fluttered her eyelashes at the brutish-looking king of Kerik.
"Don't do that, Sinedra," he told her irritably. "I'm having enough trouble with this as it is."
He almost glared at her.
"All right," he said finally. "As long as we all understand that she is not going to make any decisions, I will go along with the idea. I don't like it much, but that is beside the point, I suppose."
He stood up and bowed to her.
"Your Majesty," he said, looking as if the words nearly choked him.
Sinedra beamed at him and instinctively tried to respond to his bow.
"Don't bow, Sinedra," he advised her with a pained look. "The Overlord of the West does not bow to anyone."
He turned in exasperation to the King of Drasnia.
"That isn't going to work, Rodar.
What are we going to call her? The Overlady of the West? We'll be the laughing stock of the 12 kingdoms if we do." "We call her the Riven King, my dear Anheg,"
King Rodar replied urbanely.
"And we break the head of any man who refuses to bow to her."
"You can count on that," Anheg scowled. "If I bow to her, everybody's going to bow to her."
"I'm glad that's all been settled."
A familiar voice came from a dim corner of the council chamber.
Lady Polgara?
Zinedra gasped with a certain confusion.
I did not realize you were here.
That's fairly obvious,
Polgara replied.
You have been busy, haven't you, dear?
Zinedra
faltered. Polgara carefully set down her teacup and moved into the light. Her face was serious, but there was a faintly amused twinkle in her eyes as she examined the armor-clad princess.
Very interesting,
was all she said. Zinedra was crushed.
Gentlemen, Polgara said to the council, I am sure you still have much to discuss. In the meantime, Her Majesty and I need to have a little discussion of our own. I am sure you'll excuse us.
She moved toward the door.
Come along, Zinedra, she said,
without so much as a backward glance. Trembling, the princess followed her from the room. Polgara said nothing until the door to her own chambers had closed behind them. Then she turned and looked gravely at the princess in her armor.
I have heard about what you've been up to, Zinedra. Would you care to explain? They were all arguing so much, Zinedra began lamely. They needed somebody to unite them. And you decided to take that upon yourself? Well, how did you know they were arguing?
Zinedra flushed guiltily.
I see, Polgara murmured. You have discovered how to use my sister's amulet. How clever of you. Let me do it, Lady Polgara, Zinedra pleaded suddenly. Let me lead them. I know I can do it. Let me prove that I'm fit to be Geryon's queen.
Polgara gazed at her thoughtfully.
You are growing up very rapidly, Zinedra, she said finally. You will let me do it? We will talk about it. Take off your helmet and shield, dear, and stand your sword over in the corner. I'll make us a nice cup of tea, and you can tell me exactly what you've got in mind. I would rather not have any surprises once we get started in this. You are going with us?
For some reason that startled Zinedra.
Well, of course I am,
Polgara told her. She smiled then.
Possibly I can keep at least you out of trouble. I seem not to have had much success with Geryon.
She stopped and looked rather pointedly at Zinedra's breastplate.
Isn't that a trifle overdone, dear?
Zinedra blushed.
I thought it would be more... well...
She floundered with it defensively.
Zinedra, Polgara told her, you don't have to be so self-conscious. You are still a young girl, after all. Give it some time. Things will improve. I am so flat,
the princess wailed, almost in despair about it.
A thought occurred to her. Do you suppose that you could, well...
She made a sort of gesture.
No, dear, Polgara said firmly. That would not be a good idea. It would do some very strange things to certain necessary balances within you. And those are not the sort of things to be tempered with. Just be patient. If nothing else, a few children will fill you out. Oh, Lady Polgara, Zinedra said with a helpless little laugh. You seem to know everything. You're like the mother I never had.
Impulsively, she threw her arms about Polgara's neck. Polgara wrinkled her nose.
Zinedra, she suggested. Why don't you take off your armor? You smell like an iron pot.
Zinedra began to laugh. In the days that followed, a number of people left Riva on important missions. Barak sailed north to Val Alorn to attend the outfitting of the Kerak fleet. Mandaralan left for Vomimbre to report to King Coradulin. The fiery young Laldaran, who had received a pardon at Geryon's request, took ship to return to Asturia to make certain preparations there. Hetar, Relg, and Colonel Brendig departed for Kamar, where they would separate and each would return home to oversee the final stages of the mobilization. Events, which always moved at their own pace, began to stir and quicken as the West moved inexorably toward war. Chapter 24 Princess Zinedra soon discovered that Alorns were a surprisingly emotional people. She was forced, from the outset, to abandon the stereotyped Tolnedran view of this northern race as brutish savages, ravening on the extreme edges of civilization. She found them instead to be an extraordinarily complex people, often capable of an extreme range of highly subtle emotions. There was nothing subtle, however, about the apoplectic fury of King Anheg of Herek, when he came bursting into the council chamber a few days later with his eyes bulging and his face aflame.
"Do you have any idea what you have done?" he bellowed at Tenedra.
"Done to what, Your Majesty?"
she replied calmly.
"To Kerak,"
he shouted, his dented crown sliding down over one ear.
"This little game you've been playing gave my wife the brilliant idea that she's going to run my country while I'm gone."
"She is your wife, King Anheg,"
Tenedra pointed out coolly.
"It is only proper that she should mind the kingdom in your absence."
"Mind?" he almost screamed. "Aelina doesn't have a mind. There is nothing between her ears but empty air."
"Why did you marry her, then?"
"It certainly wasn't for her mind."
"She might surprise you, Anheg," King Rodar suggested with an amused look on his face.
"The only thing that would be a surprise to me would be to find anything left when I get back," Anheg retorted, collapsing in a chair. "And there's nothing I can do to stop her. No matter what I say, she will assume the throne as soon as I leave. It's going to be a disaster. Women have no business in politics. They are too weak-brained for it."
"I'm afraid that suggestion won't endear you very much in this particular company, Anheg," King Rodar chuckled, glancing at Polgara. One of her eyebrows had shot up at Anheg's last remark.
"Oh, sorry, Polgara," Anheg muttered, embarrassed. "I did not mean you, of course. I don't really think of you as a woman."
"I wouldn't pursue it any further, Anheg," King Rodar advised him. "You have blundered quite enough for one day already."
"That's all right, Rodar," Polgara said in a frigid tone. "I find the observations of the King of Herek most interesting."
Anheg winced.
"I really can't understand you, my friend," King Rodar said to Anheg. "You've given yourself the finest education in the North. You have studied art and poetry and history and the philosophies. But on this one subject, you are as blind as an illiterate peasant. What disturbs you so much about the idea of a woman with authority?"
It's unnatural," Anheg blurted. "Women were not meant to rule. The whole idea violates the order of things."
"I'm not certain that we are getting anywhere with this," Polgara observed. "If you gentlemen will excuse us, Her Majesty and I still have preparations to make."
She rose and led Tenedra from the council chamber.
"He's very excitable, isn't he?"
Tenedra said, as the two of them passed through the corridors of Iron Grip's citadel toward Lady Polgara's apartments.
"He tends to be overdramatic at times," Polgara replied. "These outbursts of his are not always genuine. Sometimes he behaves the way he does because he thinks people expect it of him."
She frowned slightly.
"He is right about one thing, though. Aelina is not qualified to rule. I think we will have to have a talk with her, and with the other ladies as well."
She opened the door to her apartment, and the two of them went inside. Most of the damage that had resulted from Polgara's vast rage had been repaired, and there remained only a few scorch marks on the stone walls to testify to the violence of her fury. She seated herself at a table and turned again to the letter which had arrived that morning from Queen Porin in Brasnia.
"I think it is rather obvious that we are not going to be able to catch up with my father and the others now. But at least there is one thing we won't have to worry about any more," she observed somewhat regretfully.
"Which one is that?"
Tenedra asked, seating herself across the table from Polgara.
"There had been some question about my father's recovery from that collapse he suffered last winter. But from what Porin says, he is completely back to normal, although that's not an unmixed blessing." She laid Porin's letter aside. "I think the time has come for us to have a little talk, Tenedra. You have done a great deal of maneuvering and manipulating in the past few weeks. Now, I want to know exactly what's behind it all. Precisely why have you seen fit to ram your new status down everyone's throat?"
Tenedra flushed.
I am the Riven Queen, after all, Lady Polgra,
she replied stiffly.
Don't be absurd. You are wearing a fictional crown because Rodar decided to let you wear it, and because he has convinced Anheg and Brand and Kohag that you are not going to do any damage. Now, what is behind all of this?
Polgra's look was very direct, and Tenedra squirmed uncomfortably.
We have to bring in the Errands, and my father's legions,
she said, as if that explained it.
That's fairly obvious. But the Alorn kings would not be able to do it. Why not? Because a committee cannot win people's hearts.
It was out in the open now, and Tenedra rushed on.
Geryon could have done it. The entire West would have risen at the call of the Riven King. But Geryon is not here, so somebody else has to do it. I have studied history, Lady Polgra. No army led by a committee has ever succeeded. The success of an army depends upon the spirit of the soldiers, and the soldiers have to have one leader, someone who fires their imagination. And you have elected yourself? It doesn't have to be anybody brilliant or anything, not really. It has just got to be somebody visible and unusual. And you think that a woman is going to be unusual enough and visible enough to raise an army? And, incidentally, to pose enough of a threat to attract the undivided attention of Tower Ugos and Zakath, the Malorian Emperor? Well, it has never been done before.
Tenedra felt a little defensive about it.
A lot of things have never been done before, Tenedra. That is not necessarily the best recommendation. And what convinced you that I was not qualified?
Tenedra swallowed hard.
You were so angry,
she faltered.
And I was not sure how long you were going to stay angry. Somebody had to take charge immediately. Besides,
she hesitated.
Go on. My father doesn't like you?
Tenedra blurted.
He has never ordered his legions to follow you. I am the only one who has a chance to convince him that he ought to join us. I'm sorry, Lady Polgara, I did not mean to offend you.
Polgara, however, waved that aside. Her face was thoughtful as she considered Tenedra's arguments.
It would seem that you have given the matter some thought, she concluded. All right, Tenedra, we will try it your way, for now. Just don't do anything exotic. Now, I think we had better have a talk with the ladies.
The conference that took place in Polgara's apartments that afternoon concerned matters of state. She waited quietly until the little group had all gathered, and then she spoke to them rather gravely.
Ladies,
she began,
in a very short time, the Alorns and others will be taking the field on an expedition of some importance.
You mean war, Paul?
Queen Layla asked in a sinking voice.
We are going to try to avoid that, if it is at all possible,
Polgara replied.
At any rate, the departure of your husband and the Alorn kings will leave affairs at home in your hands, and the same holds true for each of you. I wanted to go over a few things with all of you before we left.
She turned to Queen Aelina, who was splendidly gowned in red velvet.
Your husband is somewhat less than enthusiastic about any arrangements that will leave you in charge of Kerik, Aelina.
Aelina sniffed.
Anheg can be tiresome at times. Try not to agitate him. Drop a hint or two that you will allow yourself to be guided by advisers that he trusts. It will set his mind at rest a bit.
Polgra looked around at them.
The campaign is not likely to take us so far away that you won't be able to stay in touch with us. Not at first, anyway. If anything serious comes up, communicate with your husbands immediately. Deal with the day-to-day matters yourselves. I also think you should all stay in close contact with each other, once your husbands have left, and also with Porin in Boktor and Maya Serena in Vomimbri. You all have your strengths and your weaknesses, but if you are not afraid to seek advice from each other, everything will be all right.
Possibly. We should arrange for some kind of network for communications,
Queen Layla mused thoughtfully.
Relays of horses, messengers, fast ships, that sort of thing.
The Tol Nedrans have done that for centuries. I'm sure you will be able to arrange it, Layla.
Polara smiled at her.
The one thing you all must remember is to pay close attention to anything that Porin tells you. I know she's very young and a bit shy about putting herself forward, but Drasnian intelligence will report directly to her, and she will be aware of things long before any of the rest of you are. And I want you all to keep a particularly close watch on the Tol Nedrans. They like to take advantage of periods of turmoil. Absolutely do not sign anything offered to you by a Tol Nedran, no matter how attractive it may look. I trust Ranbarun about as much as I would trust a fox in a henhouse. No offense intended, Sinedra.
I know my father too, Lady Polgara,
Princess Sinedra replied with a smile.
Please, ladies, Polgara told them firmly. No adventures while I am gone. Just try to keep things running smoothly, and do not be afraid to consult with one another. You will also want to keep in touch with Xantha. The Dryads have access to a great deal of information about what's going on in the south. If any real emergency arises, get word to me immediately.
Will you want me to keep the little boy?
Merrill asked.
I'll be at Val Arlorn with Aelina, so he will be safe with me. My girls are very fond of him, and he seems to be happy with us.
Polgara thought about it for a moment.
No, she decided finally. Aran's going to have to go with me. Aside from Geryon, he is the only person in the world who can touch the orb. The Angorax may realize that and try to take him.
I'll care for him,
Tyba offered in her rich voice.
He knows me, and we are comfortable with each other. It will give me something to do.
Oh, surely you're not planning to go along on the campaign, Tyba,
Queen Layla objected. Tyba shrugged.
And why not?
She replied.
I don't have a house to keep or a kingdom to oversee. There are other reasons, too.
They all understood.
What existed between Tyba and Urelg was so profound that it seemed somehow outside the sphere of normal human attachments. And the Ulgo's absence had caused the strange woman something rather close to physical pain. It was now obvious that she intended to follow him, even into battle, if necessary. Arianna, the blonde membrane girl who had accompanied Laldurin of Wildentor to Riva, cleared her throat in preparation to raising a matter of some delicacy.
"The lives of women are circumscribed by propriety,"
she noted.
"Though battle doth rage about her, and rude war turneth all to confusion, a lady must not be unattended in the midst of an army, lest her reputation suffer. Lady Adara and I have of late held some conversation concerning this, and have concluded that we must accompany Princess Sinedra as her companions. We would do this out of duty, even were we not impelled by love."
"Very nicely put, Arianna,"
Adara murmured without any hint of a smile.
"Oh, dear," Queen Layla sighed.
"Now I have two more to worry about."
"I think that covers everything, then," Polgara said. "Running a kingdom is not all that much different from running a house, and you have all had experience at that. Don't change any major policies and do not sign any treaties. Aside from that, just let yourselves be guided by common sense. I think we can join the gentlemen now. It is getting on toward supper time, and men tend to grow restless if they are not fed regularly."
A few days later, Barak returned to Riva, accompanied by a lean-faced Drasnian nobleman. The two of them immediately went to the council chamber to report to the kings. Princess Sinedra considered following them into the conference, but decided against it. Her presence might inhibit the discussion, and she had another way to find out what was going on. She retired quickly to her rooms and touched her fingertips to the amulet at her throat.
"Going fairly well,"
she heard Barak's voice say, after she had finally located the conversation she wished to hear.
"The fleet is ready to move out of Valalorn, and Queen Porin's got the Drasnian pikemen gathering just south of Bokdor. The mobilization's very nearly complete. I think we've got some problems, though. Count Skerol here has just returned from Tul Mordu. All the reports out of northern Khalmurgos have been channeled to him, so he can give us a fairly clear assessment of the situation there.
King Rodar cleared his throat.
Kara's a very senior member of the intelligence service, he said by way of introduction. I have always found his reports to be extremely accurate.
Your Majesty is too kind, an unfamiliar voice responded.
Have the southern Murgos begun their march north? King Un had asked.
It goes a bit farther than that, Your Majesty, Carol replied.
All reports I have indicate that the march is nearly completed. There are somewhat an excess of 4 million of them encamped in the vicinity of Rakgoska.
What? Anheg exclaimed.
It appears that Tsar Urgos began the march sometime last fall, the Drasnian told him.
In the winter?
It seems so, Your Majesty. I imagine that cost him a few of his men, King Hohag said. 100,000 or so, Your Majesty, Carol answered. But human life does not mean that much to Tsar Urgos.
This changes everything, Rodar, Anheg said tersely. Our advantage has always been the time that march was going to take. We have lost that now.
Unfortunately, there's more, Your Majesty, Farrell continued. The Western Malorians have begun to arrive at Tul Zelek. Their numbers aren't really that significant yet, but they are ferrying in several thousand a day.
We've got to cut that off as quickly as we can, Anheg growled. Roldar, can you get your engineers to the eastern escarpment within a month? I'm going to have to portage a fleet across to the headwaters of the River Mardu. We have got to get ships into the Sea of the East as soon as possible. If we do not head off Zakath, his Malorians will swarm us under.
I'll send word to Porin immediately, Rodar agreed.
One wonders if the noble count has any good news, the Earl of Selene suggested dryly. There is some possibility of division in the enemy ranks, my lord, Carol replied. Tsar Urgas is behaving as if he considered himself the only possible choice as over-general of the Angarak armies. At the moment, he has got the advantage of numbers on his side. That may change if the Malorians manage to land a big enough army. There are rumors that Zakath would like to dispute the leadership of Tsar Urgas, but he is reluctant to try it in the face of 4 million Murgos.
Let's try to keep it that way, Rodar said. Tsar Urgas is insane, and crazy men make mistakes. I have heard about Zakath, and I would rather not face him in the field.
King Sohag spoke wryly.
Even as it stands, without the Malorians, we are going to be taking the field at about a 2-to-1 disadvantage. And that is assuming that we can persuade the Arryns and Tonedrins to join us.
It's a rotten way to start a war, Rodar, Anheg complained.
We'll just have to adjust our tactics, Rodar replied. We have got to avoid a pitched battle as long as possible, to save as many men as we can.
I thought we were not even considering a battle, Barak objected. And Belgarath said that all he wants is a diversion.
The situation has changed, Barak, King Rodar declared. We had not counted on the southern Murgos, or the Malorians being in place this soon. We are going to have to do something a bit more significant than stage a few hit-and-run attacks. The Angaraks have enough men now to be able to ignore minor raids and skirmishes. If we don't make a major thrust, and very soon, they will spread out all over the eastern half of the continent.
Belgarath doesn't like it when you change plans on him, Anheg reminded Rodar.
Belgarath isn't here, and he does not know what is going on. If we do not act rather decisively, he and Bulgarian and Kaldor haven't a hope of getting through.
You're talking about a war that we cannot win, Rodar, Anheg said bluntly.
I know, King Rodar admitted.
There was a long silence.
So, that's the way it is, then, Brand said finally.
I'm afraid so, Rodar told them somberly. There has to be a diversion, or Belgarion and his sword will never get to the meeting with Torak. That's the only thing that really matters. And we all have to lay down our lives, if necessary, to make it happen.
You're going to get us all killed, Rodar, Anheg said bluntly. And all our armies with us.
If that is what it takes, Anheg, Rodar answered grimly. If Belgarion does not get to Torak, our lives don't mean anything anyway. Even if we all have to die to get him there, it is still worth it.
Senedra's fingertips slid numbly from her amulet as she fell back in her chair. Suddenly she began to weep.
I won't do it, she sobbed. I can't.
She saw before her a multitude. An army of widows and orphans all staring accusingly at her, and she shrank from their eyes. If she perpetrated this horror, the rest of her life would be spent in an agony of self-loathing. Still weeping, she stumbled to her feet, fully intending to rush to the council chamber and declare that she would have nothing further to do with this futile war. But then she stopped, as the image of Geryon's face rose in her mind, that serious face with the unruly hair she always wanted to straighten. He depended on her. If she shrank from this, the Angrax would be free to hunt him down, his very life, and with it the future of the world, was in her hands. She had no choice but to continue. If only she did not know that the campaign was doomed. It was the knowledge of the disaster that awaited them that made it all so terrible. Knowing that it was useless, she began to tug at the chain that held the amulet about her neck. Had it not been for the amulet, she would have remained blissfully ignorant of what lay ahead. Still sobbing, she yanked frantically at the chain, ignoring the sting as it cut into the soft skin of her neck.
I hate you,
she blurted irrationally at the silver amulet with its crowned tree. But it was useless. The medallion would remain chained about her neck for the rest of her life. Ashen-faced, Zinedra let her hands drop. Even if she were able to remove the amulet, what good would it do? She already knew, and she must conceal the knowledge in her heart. If the faintest hint of what she knew showed on her face or her voice, she would fail, and Geryon would suffer for her failure. She must steel herself and face the world as if certain of victory. And so it was that the Riven Queen drew herself erect and bravely lifted her chin, even though her heart lay like lead in her breast. Chapter 25. Barak's new ship was larger by half than most of the other Kerak war boats in the fleet, but she moved before the spring breeze like a gull skimming low over the water. Fleecy white clouds ran across the blue sky, and the surface of the Sea of the Winds sparkled in the sunlight as the great ship heeled over and cut cleanly through the waves. Low on the horizon before them rose the green shoreline of the Hook of Arendia. They were 2 days out from Riva, and the Kerak fleet spread out behind them in a vast crowd of sails, carrying the grey-cloaked ravens to join the armies of King Fulrak of Sindaria. Zinedra nervously paced the deck near the prow, her blue cloak tossing in the wind and her armor gleaming. Despite the dreadful knowledge concealed in her heart, there was an excitement to all of this. The gathering of men, swords, and ships, the running before the wind, the sense of a unified purpose, all combined to make her blood race and to fill her with an exhilaration she had never felt before. The coast ahead loomed larger, a white sand beach backed by the dark green of the Arendish forest. As they neared the shoreline,
An armored knight on a huge roan stallion emerged from the trees and rode down the beach to the edge of the water where foamy breakers crashed on the damp sand. The princess shaded her eyes with one hand and peered intently at the gleaming knight. Then, as he turned with a broad sweep of his arm, which told them to continue up the coast, she saw the crest on his shield. Her heart suddenly soared.
"Mandarallan!"
she cried out in a vibrant trumpet note as she clung to the ropes in the very prow of Barak's ship with the wind whipping at her hair. The great knight waved a salute and, spurring his charger, galloped through the seething foam at the edge of the beach, the silver and blue pennon at the tip of his lance snapping and streaming over his head. Their ship heeled over as Barak swung the tiller, and, separated by 100 yards or so of foaming surf, the ship and the rider on the beach kept abreast of each other. It was a moment Senedra would remember for all of her life. A single image so perfect that it seemed forever frozen in her memory. The great ship flew before the wind, cutting the sparkling blue water, with her white sails booming. The mighty warhorse on the beach plunged through the gleaming foam at the edge of the sand, with spray flying out from beneath his great hooves. Locked together in that endless moment, ship and rider raced along in the warm spring sunshine toward a wooded promontory a mile ahead, with Senedra exulting in the ship's prow and her flaming hair streaming like a banner. Beyond the promontory lay a sheltered cove, and drawn up on the beach stood the camp of the Sindarian army, row upon orderly row of dun-colored tents. Barak swung his tiller over, and his sails flapped as the ship coasted into the cove, with the great Kerak fleet close behind.
"Ho, Mandarallan!"
Barak bellowed, as the anchor ropes sang and great iron anchors plunged down through the crystal-clear water toward the sandy bottom.
"Ah, my lord Barak,"
Mandarallan shouted his reply.
"Welcome to Orindia. Lord Brendig hath devised a means to speed thy disembarking."
He pointed to where 100 or so Sindarian soldiers were busily poling a series of large rafts into position, lashing them together to form a long floating wharf extending out into the waters of the cove. Barak laughed.
"Trust the Sindar to come up with something practical."
"Can we go ashore now?" King Rodar asked plaintively as he emerged from the cabin. The king was not a good sailor, and his broad, round face had a pale, greenish cast to it. He looked oddly comical in his mail shirt and helmet, and the ravages of seasickness on his face added little to his dignity. Despite his unwarlike exterior, however, the other kings had already begun to defer to his wisdom. Beneath his vast rotundity, Rodar concealed a genius for tactics and a grasp of overall strategy that made the others turn to him almost automatically and accept his unspoken leadership. A small fishing boat had been pressed into service as a ferry drew alongside Barak's ship, almost before the anchors had settled, and the kings and their generals and advisers were transferred to the beach in less than half an hour.
"I think that I am hungry,"
Rodar announced the moment he stepped onto solid ground. Unheg laughed.
"I think that you were born hungry."
The king wore a mail shirt and had a broad sword belt about his waist. His coarse features seemed less out of place somehow now that he was armed.
"I haven't been able to eat for 2 days, Unheg," Rodar groaned. "My poor stomach is beginning to think that I have abandoned it."
"Food hath been prepared, your majesty,"
Mandarallan assured him.
"Our Asturian brothers have provided goodly numbers of the king's deer, doubtless obtained lawfully, though I chose not to investigate that too closely."
Someone standing in the group behind Mandarallan laughed, and Tenedra looked at the handsome young man with reddish gold hair and the longbow slung over the shoulder of his green doublet. Senedra had not had much opportunity to become acquainted with Laldoran of Wildentor while they had been at Reva. She knew him to be Geryon's closest friend, however, and she realized the importance of gaining his confidence. It should not be too hard, she decided as she looked at his open, almost innocent face.
The gaze he returned was very direct, and one glance into those eyes told the princess that there was a vast sincerity and very little intelligence behind them.
"We have heard from Belgarath,"
Barak advised Mandorallan and the young Astorian.
"Where are they?"
Lulduran demanded eagerly.
"They were in Bokhtor,"
King Rodar replied, his face still a trifle green from his bout of seasickness.
"For reasons of her own, my wife let them pass through. I imagine they're somewhere in Gorognadrak by now."
Lulduran's eyes flashed.
"Maybe if I hurry, I can catch up with them,"
he said eagerly, already starting to look around for his horse.
"It is 1,500 leagues, Lulduran,"
Barak pointed out politely.
"Oh,"
Lulduran seemed a bit crestfallen.
"I suppose you're right. It would be a little difficult to catch up with him now, wouldn't it?"
Barak nodded gravely.
And then the blonde membrate girl, Ariana, stepped forward, her heart in her eyes.
"My lord,"
she said to Lulduran, and Synedra remembered with a start that the two were married. Technically, at least.
"Thine absence hath given me great pain."
Lulduran's eyes were immediately stricken.
"Ah, my Ariana,"
he almost choked.
"I swear that I'll never leave you again."
He took both her hands in his and gazed adoringly into her eyes. The gaze she returned was just as full of love and just as empty of thought. Synedra shuddered inwardly at the potential for disaster implicit in the look the two exchanged.
"Does anyone care that I'm starving to death right here on this spot?" Rodar asked.
The banquet was laid on a long table set up beneath a gaily striped pavilion on the beach, not far from the edge of the forest. The table, quite literally, groaned under its weight of roasted game, and there was enough to eat to satisfy even the enormous appetite of King Rodar. When they had finished eating, they lingered at the table in conversation.
"Thy son, Lord Hethar, has advised us that the Elgar clans are gathering at the stronghold, Your Majesty,"
Mandorallan reported to King Khohag. Khohag nodded.
"And we have had word from the Ulgo Relg,"
Colonel Brendig added.
"He has gathered a small army of warriors from the caves. They will wait for us on the Algarian side of the mountains. He said that you would know the place."
Barak grunted.
"The Ulgos can be troublesome. They are afraid of open places, and daylight hurts their eyes. But they can see in the dark like cats. They could be very useful at some point."
"Did Relg send any personal messages?"
Taiba asked Brendig with a little catch in her voice. Gravely, the Sindar took a folded parchment from inside his tunic and handed it to her. She took it with a rather helpless expression and opened it, turning it this way and that.
"What is the matter, Taiba?"
Adara asked quietly.
"He knows that I cannot read,"
Taiba protested, holding the note tightly pressed against her.
"I will read it to you,"
Adara offered.
"But maybe it is, well, personal,"
Taiba objected.
"I promise I won't listen,"
Adara told her without a trace of a smile. Tenedra covered her own smile with her hand. Adara's penetrating and absolutely straight-faced wit was one of the qualities that most endeared her to the princess. Even as she smiled, however, Tenedra could feel eyes on her, and she knew that she was being examined with great curiosity by the Arryns, both Astorian and Mimbrite, who had joined them. Lulduran, in particular, seemed unable to take his eyes from her. The handsome young man sat close beside the blonde Mimbrite girl, Ariana, and stared openly at Tenedra, even while unconsciously, perhaps, he held Ariana's hand. Tenedra endured his scrutiny with a certain nervousness. To her surprise, she found that she wanted this rather foolish young man's approval.
"Tell me,"
she said directly to him,
"what are these sentiments here in Astoria?
Concerning our campaign, I mean?
Leldoran's eyes clouded.
Unenthusiastic, for the most part, Your Majesty. I am afraid there is suspicion that this might all be some Mimbrate plot. But that is absurd,
Tenedra declared. Leldoran shrugged.
It is the way of my countrymen, the way they think. And those who do not think it is a plot are looking at the idea that all of the Mimbrite knights might join a crusade against the East. That raises certain hopes in some quarters.
Mandarallan sighed. The same sentiments exist in some parts of Mimbre. We are a woefully divided kingdom, and old hatreds and suspicions die hard.
Tenedra felt a sudden wave of consternation. She had not counted on this. King Rodar had made it plain that he absolutely had to have the errands. And now the idiotic hatred and suspicion between Mimbre and Asturia seemed about to bring the entire plan crashing down around her ears. Helplessly, she turned to Polgara. The sorceress, however, seemed undisturbed by the news that the Erens were reluctant to join the campaign.
Tell me, Leldoran, she said calmly. Could you gather some of your less suspicious friends in one place, some secure place where they won't be afraid we might want to ambush them?
What have you got in mind, Polgara?
King Rodar asked, his eyes puzzled.
Someone's going to have to talk to them, Polgara replied. Someone rather special, I think.
She turned back to Leldoran.
I don't think we'll want a large crowd. Oh, not at first, anyway. 40 or 50 ought to be enough, and no one too violently opposed to our cause.
I will gather them at once, Lady Polgara,
Leldoran declared, impulsively leaping to his feet.
It is rather late, Leldoran, she pointed out, glancing at the sun hovering low over the horizon.
The sooner I start, the sooner I can gather them,
Leldoran said fervently.
If friendship and the ties of blood have any sway at all, I will not fail.
He bowed deeply to Tenedra.
Your Majesty,
he said by way of farewell, and ran to where his horse was tethered.
Ariana sighed as she looked after the departing young enthusiast. Is he always like that?
Tenedra asked her curiously.
The Mimbrate girl nodded.
Always,
she admitted.
Thought and deed are simultaneous with him. He hath no understanding of the meaning of the word reflection, I fear. It doth add to his charm, but it is sometimes disconcerting, I must admit. I can imagine,
Tenedra agreed.
Later, when the princess and Polgara were alone in their tent, Tenedra turned a puzzled look upon Garion's aunt.
What are we going to do?
Not we, Tenedra. You are going to have to talk with them.
I am not very good at speaking in public, Lady Polgara,
Tenedra confessed, her mouth going dry.
Crowds frighten me, and I get all tongue-tied.
You will get over it, dear, Polgara assured her.
She looked at the princess with a slightly amused expression.
You are the one who wanted to lead an army, remember? Did you really think that all you were going to have to do was to put on your armor, jump into the saddle and shout, "Follow me," and then the whole world would fall in behind you?
Well,
you spent all that time studying history and missed the one thing all great leaders have had in common. You must have been very inattentive, Tenedra.
Tenedra stared at her with a slowly dawning horror.
It doesn't take that much to raise an army, dear. You don't have to be brilliant. You don't have to be a warrior. Your cause doesn't even have to be great and noble. All you have to do is to be eloquent.
I cannot do that, Lady Polgara.
You should have thought of that before, Tenedra. It is too late to go back now. Rodar will command the army and see to it that all of the details are taken care of, but you are the one who will have to make them want to follow you.
I would not have the faintest idea what to say to them,
Tenedra protested. It will come to you, dear. You do believe in what you're doing, don't you?
Well, of course, but...
You decided to do this, Sinedra. You decided it all by yourself. And as long as you have come this far, you might as well go all of the way.
Please, Lady Pulchra,
Sinedra begged.
Speaking in public makes me sick of my stomach. I will throw up.
That happens now and then, Pulchra observed calmly. Just try not to do it in front of everybody.
3 days later, the princess, Pulchra, and the Elorn kings journeyed to the ruined city of Vo'oster, deep in the silences of the Arindish forest. Sinedra rode through the sunny woods in a state hovering on the verge of panic. In spite of all of her arguments, Pulchra had remained adamant. Tears had not budged her. Hysterics had failed. The princess was morbidly convinced that even if she were to die, Pulchra would prop her up in front of the waiting throng and make her go through the agony of addressing them. Feeling absolutely helpless, she rode to meet her fate. Like Vo'achun, Vo'oster had been laid waste during the dark centuries of the Arindish Civil War. Its tumbled stones were green with moss, and they lay in the shade of vast trees that seemed to mourn the honor, pride, and sorrow of Asturia. Lalduran was waiting, and with him were perhaps 50 richly dressed young noblemen, their eyes filled with curiosity, faintly tinged with suspicion.
"It is as many as I could bring together in a short time, Lady Pulchra,"
Lalduran apologized after they had dismounted.
"There are others in the region, but they are convinced that our campaign is some kind of mimbre treachery."
"These will do nicely, Lalduran. They'll spread the word about what happens here."
She looked around at the mossy, sun-dappled ruins.
"I think that spot over there will be fine." She pointed at a broken bit of one of the walls. "Come with me, Sinedra."
The princess, dressed in her armor, hung her helmet and shield on the saddle of the white horse King Clohag had brought for her from Algaria, and led the patient animal as she tremblingly followed the sorceress.
"We want them to be able to see you, dear, as well as to hear you. So climb up on that piece of wall and speak from there. The spot where you will be standing is in the shade now, but the sun's moving around so that it will be fully on you as you finish your speech. I think that will be a nice touch."
Sinedra quailed as she saw how far the sun had to go.
"I think I'm going to be sick,"
she said in a quivering little voice.
Maybe later, Sinedra. You don't have time just now."
Pulchra turned to Lalduran.
"I think you can introduce Her Majesty now."
Lalduran stepped onto the wall and held up his hand for silence.
"Countrymen," he announced in a loud voice, "last Eris died. An event took place which shook our world to its foundations. For 1,000 years and more we have awaited that moment. My countrymen, the Raven King has returned."
The throng stirred at his announcement, and an excited buzz rippled through it. Lalduran, always extravagant, warmed to his subject. He told them of the flaming sword that had announced Geryon's true identity, and one of the oaths of fealty sworn to Belgarion of Reva by the Elorn kings. Sinedra, almost fainting with nervousness, scarcely heard him. She tried to run over her speech in her mind, but it all kept getting jumbled. Then, in a near panic, she heard him say,
"Countrymen, I present to you Her Imperial Highness, Princess Sinedra, the Raven Queen."
And all eyes turned expectantly to her. Trembling in every limb, she mounted the broken wall and looked at the faces spread out before her. All her preparations, all of the rehearsed phrases, evaporated from her mind. And she stood, white-faced and shaking, without the faintest idea of how to begin. The silence was dreadful. As chance had it, one of the young Asturians in the very front had tasted perhaps more wine that morning than was good for him.
"I think Her Majesty has forgotten her speech,"
he snickered loudly to one of his companions. Tenedra's reaction was instantaneous.
"And I think the gentleman has forgotten his manners,"
she flared, not even stopping to think. Incivility infuriated her.
"I don't think I'm going to listen to this,"
the tipsy young man declared, in a tone filled with exaggerated boredom.
"It is just a waste of time. I am not driving, and neither are any of the rest of you. What could a foreign queen possibly say that would be of any interest to Asturian patriots?"
And he started to turn away.
"Is the patriotic Asturian gentleman so wine-soaked that he has forgotten that there is more to the world than this forest?"
Tenedra retorted hotly.
"Or perhaps he is so unschooled that he does not know what is happening out there?"
She leveled a threatening finger at him.
"Hear me, patriot,"
she said in a ringing voice.
"You may think that I am just here to make some pretty little speech, but what I have come to say to you is the most important thing you will ever hear. You can listen, or you can turn your back and walk away. And a year from now, when there is no Asturia, and when your homes are smoking in ruins, and the Grolems are herding your families to the altar of Torak with its fire and its bloody knives, you can look back on this day and curse yourself for not listening."
And then, as if her anger with this one rude young man had suddenly burst a dam within her, Tenedra began to speak. She spoke to them directly, not with studied phrases like she had rehearsed, but with words that came from her heart. The longer she spoke, the more impassioned she became. She pleaded, she cajoled, and finally she commanded. She would never remember exactly what it was she had said, but she would never forget how she felt as she said it. All the passion and fire that had filled the stormy outbursts and tantrums of her girlhood came into full play. She spoke fervently, with no thought of herself, but rather with an all-consuming belief in what she said. In the end, she won them over. As the sun fell full upon her, her armor gleamed, and her hair seemed to leap into flame.
"Belgarion, King of Riva and Overlord of the West, calls you to war,"
she declared to them.
"I am Tenedra, his queen, and I stand before you as a living banner. Who among you will answer Belgarion's call and follow me?"
It was the young man who had laughed at her whose sword leaped first into his hand. Raising it in salute, he shouted, "I will follow." As if his declaration were a signal, half a hundred swords flashed in the sunlight as they were raised in salute and pledge, and half a hundred voices echoed his shout, "I will follow." With a broad sweep of her arm, Tenedra drew her own sword and lifted it.
"Follow, then," she sang to them. "We ride to meet the fell hordes of Angarak. Let the world tremble at our coming."
With three quick steps, she reached her horse and literally threw herself into the saddle. She wheeled her prancing mount and galloped from the ruins, her sword aloft and her flaming hair streaming behind her.